Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. Welcome back everybody to this week's edition of the Triathlon Coach podcast. And my guest today is a man that most of you have probably heard of but never met. He's certainly been a friend of mine for an awful long time, and he's been around in the triathlon industry almost as long as I have, which is about 30 years. It's Mr. Ian Hamilton, who is the owner and race director for One Step Beyond and Outlaw Triathlon Events. So welcome to the show, Ian.
Good afternoon, Simon.
How are you today?
Yeah, good. We're 10 days out from this year's Outlaw, and so this is sort of busy time in the office, so yeah, okay. Spinning lots of plates, but hopefully not dropping any at the moment.
Well, you've got a good team around you to help you with spinning and maintaining the spinning of those plates, Ian, and we'll come on to that later. But let's go right back to the very beginning. I was looking through some results a few weeks ago, and believe me, the results we used to get back in 1988-89 were typed up by hand and posted to you a couple of weeks after the event, certainly not the digitised immediate results you get to these days. And your name was right up near the top of the list, in the top few, and my name was probably on page two or three. But there would only have been about 100 people racing anyway. So can you remember way back in those days, Ian, when you first started in triathlon?
Yeah. There weren't many people, and there weren't many events. So you did end up getting to know most of the people, especially if you were sort of racing against them. Most were mass participation, and you know, there weren't more than two waves normally. So yeah, you get to know the people pretty well, and a different sport, if I'm honest. I don't know whether you say it's a more friendly sport. It was certainly smaller, and it was very niche in those days, actually.
Yeah, I remember telling somebody that I was a triathlete, and they said, "Oh, do you do that Ironman stuff then?" Now, at that time, I hadn't done an Ironman, but I think people had probably seen something about Hawaii and Julie Moss crawling across the finish line, and therefore that was their only knowledge of the sport of triathlon. Otherwise, most people just classed you as a weirdo.
Yeah, fair point. I think I remember watching that documentary, just to put it into context, I'm sure it was on at 9 o'clock, first time I ever saw it. And I must have been 12 or 13, maybe. But I do remember that it was, I was allowed to stay up late and watch it. But that was my first experience of, Julie Moss crawling across the finish line at Kona. And so I was the same. If you did a triathlon, you was doing an Ironman. Thankfully that wasn't the reality, and found a pulsum event based at Ashbydale Azouche, I think it was.
So that was your first event then? What year was that, if you can remember?
85. Oh no, sorry, my first ever event was down at Home Pierpont.
Okay.
Day before the European champs, and I swam it was one width, a cycle round, and then a run round, and I wore my tennis kit because I was a tennis player at the time.
Right. And how did you get on in that first race?
I won my age group, which was the 12 to 13.
Right, okay.
And somewhere I've still got the trophy.
So that was the start of your triathlon career. You were quite were you right on the edge of being a junior then, or senior, weren't you? At 18 or 19, you were posting some pretty good results and getting on the podium.
Yeah, well, when I was a junior, we obviously had the likes of Spencer Smith and we had Simon Lessing. So both of those were world junior champions. And I guess the same as what we've got nowadays, because you've got people that are that good, you end up getting to a decent level as well. So even at 19, our the junior team, within reason, we all raced senior at the European champs and that type of thing. So as much as I think my best result was fifth in the world champs. But we were all pretty good. And so there was a nice little group that obviously most people know about, not most people, but there's an expectation some people will know about Simon and Spencer. But because we were good, the second tier of athletes and the rest of us that are going, you know, between 5th and 10th, or maybe 5th and 20th in my part, domestically we were doing really, really well. And I was fortunate to be in some podiums, or be on some podiums, but predominantly in the team category. It was good experience, and sort of like seeing how those athletes train was a definite learning curve. And, you know, still these days, I still see a lot of people that race and train and could learn a thing or two from those boys in those days.
Now, that going back to that time, there wasn't really no organised Great Britain squad to speak of, was there? There was certainly no formalised funding programme. Obviously, triathlon wasn't in the Olympics at that point. And there was definitely no junior or talent ID programme. And I think that sort of formally started after Sydney. But so what did you do about training then, Ian? Did you train like a swimmer, train like a cyclist, and train like a runner? Or did you actually manage to find a triathlon club that you could work out with?
To start with, when I was very young, it was any training was beneficial. Personally, I was a county swimmer and a reasonable runner. And the cycling just got worked into whatever was spare type thing. However, Mansfield Tri Club, I think I joined about 1989, and from there there was a committee, and on the committee they had a coach, and a chap called Mick English was actually coaching me. I think Mick English is still about nowadays.
Yeah.
And so he sort of like became my coach, and then when I did join the Great Britain squad, I think the first time I joined the Great Britain squad would probably be when we arrived at our accommodation in France for the European champs. There was nothing formal in those days. It was a letter that got sent through saying, this is where to meet, this is at the times, and I sat down, had some dinner, and met the people that I was racing with. Because within reason, if you were doing triathlon at that point and you was relatively decent, you got in the Great Britain team. Very different to nowadays, obviously. So that's sort of like how it started.
It's quite interesting that you mentioned Spencer Smith and Simon Lessing there, because they're two athletes that I looked up to when I first started in triathlon, and they were very good. You know, I think between them, they probably had at least 8 or 9 world titles. And some of the racing they had was fantastic. You know, there was a couple of, for those of you who aren't sure who Simon Lessing and Spencer Smith are, just Google them. But there was a famous incident, which you'll probably find on YouTube, of Spencer's passionate father, who used to go and support him at all the races and take him around, standing there swearing at Simon Lessing, who was running on Spencer's shoulder, right here, shot from the BBC TV cameras, and getting a bit heated there. But there were some other good athletes. Who are the people that you remember from then that are still involved in the sport today, Ian?
And that's putting me on the spot.
Well, Glenn Cook surely would have been one of them.
Yeah, Glenn Cook, Richard Hobson.
Yes, okay.
But also in those days, we had the likes of Tim Don. He was coming through as junior at the time.
Yeah.
Stuart Hayes. So there was obviously the West London little junior groups. Obviously, they followed Spencer. And I remember racing Tim and Stuart quite a few times. As they were sort of like coming through the ranks.
You'd have competed against Robin Brew, wouldn't you?
Obviously, yeah. So Robin Brew, Richard Hobson, who's obviously still racing, doing really well nowadays, actually. Julian Jenkinson, who obviously unfortunately died a couple of years ago. He was part of the Great Britain team. Sarah Springman.
Yeah.
Those people that have
royalty, triathlon royalty.
Triathlon royalty, and Sarah Coop.
Yeah,
they're the ones I sort of remember now.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, people who are involved with more on the commentary front or the organisation, Steve True and Bill Black, of course.
Steve True, Bill Black, and John Leveson.
John Leveson.
Remember John Leveson used to be out on the training camps in Malta with Steve True and that type of thing. So, yeah, there's a lot of people that were about then that are very much quite influential in the sport nowadays still.
Okay, so how long did you stay in the sport as an athlete then, and at what point did you move into other triathlon related activities?
I think stayed competing only until I was about 23, but at 22 myself and Mark Redwood started TFN, or Total Fitness Nottingham as it was at the time. So we started that up. Just, and it was crazy. It was he'd finished university and didn't want a proper job, let's say. What a mistake. We certainly turned into a proper job. And we started a little shop with not a great deal of money, selling a little bit of tri-gear, you know, Cannondale bikes, I remember, Dave Scott clothing, for anybody that remembers those days, Speedo wetsuits, I think, Snug wetsuits. And we basically started a shop with no more than about 50 items of stock in there, and built that until obviously unfortunately what happened with TFN last year when they closed down. But it was a business that was started on the shoestring that grew really well, had a great reputation through all of its existence. And then, yeah, sadly closed after 20 something years of trade, I think.
Wow. But you weren't directly involved in that. I mean, I can't see you standing behind a shop counter and pressing digits into a till. Were you more of a sleeping partner in that then?
No, we were. I think I worked in the shop for about four years in the end. I was never quite Arkwright, admittedly.
I can imagine you'd have a till like him, though.
Yeah, I would have done. At the same time, I had the events going as well, but the events was purely for fun. I started One Step Beyond as a college project when I was 17. And ultimately, you had to do a college project. It was part of my marketing. Do a college project. And as it happened, I continued with that, mainly because, A, I had the time to do it. Secondly, there weren't really any other events. And thirdly, I got an opportunity to organise the club relays, which we still do now, down at the National Water Sports Centre.
Wow, club relay. So what year did they start?
So we'll be on our 27th year. So, yeah, 1991 was the first one.
Yeah, we were talking the other day about some events that were going back right in the 90s. You know, there's the Hillingdon race, which John Levison's involved with. There's the Ilkley Tri, which started and stopped and has been and started again. There's the club relays. There was Windsor, of course, which was probably started in 92, was it?
I think Windsor was already... That'd be one we'd have to speak to John Lund about. But.
Yeah, but there's another character that's been around in the sport for as long as you are. So you guys that we've talked about earlier are part of the tapestry of triathlon in this country. And you've developed, and as you say, starting at 17, you started One Step Beyond. And organising the club relays at the venue where you did your first triathlon must have been quite surreal.
That venue is sort of played a massive part in my life. So I did my first triathlon there. I organised the club relays there. And then obviously we started Outlaw there 9 years ago and still put 2 to 3, 4 events on there every year. So it's, you know, if one place has ever massively affected my life, then that is definitely the place that's changed it ultimately as well.
Your vehicles that you have must have like an unconscious direction finder for Home Pier Pump from wherever you live, I guess, because you must spend an awful lot of time in Nottingham at that venue.
Well, at one point, myself and Mark Shaw used to live within a mile of the place. Mark owned some houses and I just rented a room from him. And so, I used to live pretty close to it. And looking to move back around that location in a few years' time as well. So, I do. It's a nice area. I never get lost going there, put it that way.
You talked about you mentioned Mark Shaw there. So you and Mark were business partners for quite a while, organising events. You are no longer, but just tell us about those years and some of the events that you used to put on.
So we had a company called Paysetter Events, which Mark still uses now. So ultimately, Mark had spent a long time trying to get into Rutland Water. I knew him. He'd moved to Nottingham. He had a good background in organising cycle events, and we had a conversation where he wanted to get into tries and basically said, look, can we work together? This is my background. That's your background. Let's work together, and it's going to work well. And he was spot on. We created the Vitruvian, which at the time, so I think it was 19 or maybe 2000 or 2001, I think we got something like 180 people in a half distance or middle distance event. There were virtually no others. Everybody was racing standard distance. We just had the Olympics. And I remember waking up on the morning of the first ever Vitruvian and we suddenly realised we'd made a bit of a mistake. So we came out and walked down to transition at 4:30 in the morning, and we'd forgot to hire any lighting. So, and in those days, phones didn't have lights. Fortunately, some competitors had been clever enough to actually bring a torch. So the whole of the transition was not lit. Literally everybody was just stood up, well, was trying to work out where the bike was, because where the venue is very dark, it's beautiful. But it was very dark. And so that was the first thing that we put on the improvement sheet for the following year. make sure we had some lights in transition for the race morning. But yeah, so that carried on for a good few years. I think it's probably until 2007, 2008. Mark was then moving away to go and start his the stables business, which is really successful. And at the same time, I wanted to develop more UK racing, obviously, and start the Outlaw.
And hence it began, the Outlaw.
And hence the Outlaw began, yeah.
Well, let's focus on the Outlaw then now. And also, you touched on something there about the first Vitruvian and walking down to transition and realising that you had no lights. Finding something fundamental like that on race morning must be one of the worst nightmares for a race director, because your heart must stop when you realise that you've forgotten something that's so important to the race.
Yeah, I don't remember quite how much the panic was, but I'm guessing it was fairly catastrophic to the actual event itself. If it was something major, then it would have affected the event. I don't remember it affecting the event. What I do remember though is the 180 people that we got that day, they were sort of like, they were hardcore. We wasn't, you know, social media marketing probably didn't exist at that point. Certainly I don't think we're doing a great deal of email marketing. It was very much, these people would have come from, you know, as literally going round with flyers at other events, adverts in 220 magazine and that type of thing. So they were pretty hardcore people, and they were able to actually, within reason, get on with the event. I think nowadays it'd have been on Twitter and Facebook within a couple of seconds, that type of mistake. But because of how the sport was at that point, it was still relatively small, and middle distance racing is very, very, very small. People just sort of like got on with it. But at every event, there is always something that just, it's fair to say, tests you a little bit.
Well, tell us about some of the other nightmares that you faced then over the 20, 25 years of being a race director.
Okay, right. I can't put them in any order.
No, that's fine. Just off the top of your head, some of the challenges you face either in the few days before the race is due to the race start or actually on race day.
Okay. There are some ones which is slightly more entertaining than others. Last year, we were driving around the Outlaw Half on the Friday afternoon, and a utility company, without telling anybody, decided to dig a big hole straight across one of the roads on the Southern Loop. And as we got there to say, "What are you doing?" And they says, "Oh, yeah, we've just got to sort this out. But we thought we'd put it on over the weekend. We're just going to close this section of road over the weekend because we know it's quiet around here." Huh. That type of thing. We find out about it in two ways. People tell us on social media, and secondly, we have a team that drives around the route fairly consistently throughout the weekend. Now, that type of thing can actually finish your race off. As it happened, we got it sorted. We spoke to Highways and got it sorted. So that type of thing will happen regularly. I guess closer to home and more recently, we obviously had a major incident at the Outlaw Half in Nottingham this year, where we had a rider that was visibly very ill very quickly, involved in quite a significant accident, and the road was closed to enable facilitating helping the rider out. But then we had to literally within 10 or 15 minutes redesign, redeploy all the stewards, move a drink station onto another section of the route. Now, we've never, in the 27 years that I've been going, we've never had to do that. And in fairness, thanks to the team that we had out on the roads, and we've actually now got quite a sizable team. We've got really good infrastructure at our event. So we have three vehicles that are able to replan. So we talk about dynamic replanning. Well, we actually did that. We moved stewards, we moved signs, we moved the road closure. Years ago, you couldn't have been able to do that.
You must obviously have plan B for certain things, but you can't cover every single eventuality. You said there that something like that's never happened in 27 years. So it'd be reasonable to say, well, why would you think of a plan B for that? You can't go through everything. You're like, okay, what would we do if a nuclear bomb goes off? Or what would we do if a sinkhole opened up and swallowed Nottingham? Those things are just so far beyond the realm of conventional thinking that you wouldn't have an alternative. The reason I'm asking this question is I'm thinking about the Ironman recently in Bolton, or that other, as we like to say, that other outlaw distance event. But you know, they've had wildfires there, and I think that's been one of the biggest moorland fires that's ever been recorded in Great Britain. It's certainly never been a part of any other race reorganisation, and yet the organisers had to do their very best to reroute the bike course because part of it went through the affected area. And yet, one would think from reading social media that it was the fault of the race organisers that this thing had taken place in the first place. So just how much alternative planning do you do before the event in case of something that's unforeseen? Or don't you?
Certain things are... Yeah, there are certain things you can affect, and you can affect them even during the race. There are certain things that you can't affect. So I guess given Ironman Bolton, and I don't know, and this is just me from the outside, but an understanding of from my point of view, we have to consult with the highways agency, the highways department, the county highways, parish councils months and months in advance. So you get, within reason, you get a tick box that says you can use this road between this time and this time. Now, it gets to a certain point, and it might be 6 weeks in one area, it might be 12 weeks in another, where you actually can't start to change things like that because there's so much work, consultation, notification that's actually gone into organising a route. Now, I don't know the full ins and outs of that particular one, but I do know from our point of view to actually change certain things, sort of like within a week of the event, does become impossible. And some people will actually look at it and go, well, surely there's a simple solution. You do this, which is very true. There is a simple solution, but every reaction will then have a knock-on effect somewhere else. And you know that's the difficulty. Is it happens when we redeployed our stewards onto a different route. The route that we had was already part of a contingency plan that we'd had agreed with the highways department.
Mm.
And so we're able to actually use, a route that we use from another event and redeploy, and things worked out quite simply. It's the work that goes on the 3 months and the 6 months that ultimately affects your race day much more than what happens the week before. Because I've eaten a lot of humble pie in various parish council meetings. And that type of thing doesn't happen the week before. That happens 3 months. 6 months, potentially a year in advance. So it's difficult. Certain things you can change and you're able to react to quickly, but certain things, particularly on the highways, you're not able to react to as quick.
Okay, we can come back to that in a minute, actually. Let's just finish off on some of the race director nightmares then that you can remember over the years. So you've obviously you have accidents, people fall off their bikes, what about some of the other stuff that's happened? Weather.
Okay.
Weather, for instance, have you had torrential downpours that have flooded sections, flooded your transition? Have you had extreme heat that has caused people to pass out and you haven't had enough medical facilities at the transition?
I think over the years, we've probably had everything going. We've certainly had, and Outlaw seems to be one of those, and Holcomb, we had Holcomb 3 weeks ago now. I think it was between 26 and up to sort of like 30 degrees on the day. Now, one of the things that we've learned is that we can, in actual fact, I've got some really boring stats about how much people will drink during an event on a hot day. And we were going through, I think, 600 litres. We're going through 600 litres of water every 20 minutes at Holcomb. And then if you actually try and work that out, and then we work that out and work out that we've got enough water on course to keep us going for the next 4 hours during the run. And it's things like that. That's what we get, what we learn about during an event. But because obviously we've got history of doing it for years. So extreme heat, we've had both ways. We've had freezing cold, downpours. Lightning strikes are always your worst. If you've got swimmers in an event and you've got a lightning strike, you've got to get them out pretty quick. We've only ever had that once, and that was at the relays about 5 or 6 years ago. And we could see the lightning coming over, and we had the last swimmer. The last swimmer got out probably about 10 or 15 minutes before we was expecting some lightning to come to the venue. As it happened, we didn't get the lightning. We just got lots and lots of water. And so it just rained for consistently 20 minutes, and those people that were racing would have remembered it. And we got close to the point of actually stopping the event because the bikes were struggling to go around. It was literally the lake lifted that much that we had lake water coming out onto the perimeter road. So we've had that. At each event, we have certain trigger points. Everybody out the swim. So once everyone's out the swim, you got a sigh of relief. You then need to check that all of your bikes have left. So if you've got all of your swimmers out theoretically, but you've still got bikes in your transition, that's when you have a problem.
I can remember one such incident actually at Wakefield, I think, where we had a problem like that.
Yeah, and I remember that one. And we found the swimmer having a cup of coffee in the cafe. But we'd nearly bought, if I do remember, it was West Yorkshire Diving Squadron or somebody to actually look for a swimmer that we thought was actually, under the water somewhere. So that's never good.
So that's a question. Like, so that in that instance, then that's a question of an athlete just not informing anybody that's an official that they've withdrawn from the race. They've just sort of quietly gone off to a, having gone, no doubt you'd have had a timing chip registration for them that looked like they were in the swim. And then when they did look like they didn't come out of the swim and there was a bike left, you'd have naturally thought they were still in the water. So it's a case of somebody not informing anybody official that they're not participating in the race and just wandering off. Which shows
that. And from their point of view, they don't think they've done anything wrong. They just think, I've got out. I'm having a bad day. I'll get out. The reality is that we then spend, I don't know, 30, 45 minutes maybe looking for this swimmer. And being right, and I think you were commentating, yeah. So we were right on the edge of actually, calling the dive team, stopping the event, because we then had to put all of our manpower into potentially finding somebody in the water still. But this person just got out.
I went
for a coffee.
I can remember a couple of years ago at the Outlaw that we got a message that the police had come on site and that they'd found a body. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Of course, there's a certain amount of panic goes through until, well, I mean, sadly, it was somebody who'd fallen into the river, wasn't it? And it wasn't actually part of the home pier pont setup. It was just right next door. But for a moment, there must have been a slight element of panic that you'd lost somebody, or that the race was going to be stopped by a group of policemen wandering around looking for something.
Yeah, that Soccer were going to turn up and close the place down. There was one benefit that I do remember when they came onto the venue. I knew we didn't have any swimmers in, and they'd found a body. So I quickly worked out that what they were actually talking about was on the river. However, there is a heart stopping moment when the police turn up at your venue and go, "We've found a body." yes, as you say, it was very unfortunate for somebody that somebody that I believe jumped in the river about 2 miles up the road and ended up quite close to the bottom of our lake, so to speak. That's never a good thing, but fortunately didn't affect the event that day.
So we talked about nightmares for race directors, and then you were telling me about negotiating with the council. So next year is the 10th year for Outlaw, so it's going to be a big celebration, no doubt. And you've got this year's race, which you said takes place in 10 days' time, or when our listeners are listening, it'll be 3 days before. At what point do you start planning for Outlaw 2019? And do you assume that because you've been using pretty much the same roads for the bike, you've been using pretty much the same run route along by the river, that you can do that again, or do you have to start from scratch for every single year and go back and negotiate with the council and the highways and all the other people that are going to have some sort of interest in that event taking place?
It's a bit of both. Taking your first question, I guess, when do we start planning for 2019? We're already planning for 2019. You have to get your dates in early. and any improvements that we can see that we need to make to this year's event will also automatically click onto next year's event as well. The way that things tend to work is we will put our data applications in well over a year in advance. For Outlaw Full, 2 to 3 years, and or for any of the Outlaw events, 2 to 3 years. But as far as the actual, the very specific work for next year about course and timings and that type of thing, within reason, the second that we put Outlaw 2018 to bed, we will then be working on 2019 full time. So after this year's Outlaw, we then go to a meeting with the SAG group, so Safety Advisory Group, and that's the ones that contains the highways, the police, the ambulance, the fire, the licensing, East Midlands Ambulance, and that type of thing. So we sit ultimately in a meeting and we debrief the event. Any issues that have been picked up then hopefully get resolved. And at that point, you get the go-ahead to then, if you've done everything okay and everything's acceptable, you then get the okay to basically formally relaunch and start dotting some I's and crossing the T's. Any new event probably takes between 18 and 24 months worth of planning, because there's a lot more work with the highways department, especially going to close roads, and the consultation of talking to affected businesses and residents and that type of thing. But it's very, there's no one point where you go, right, now today we're going to start organising next year. We, for every event that we've got in 2018, we've got a 2019 date. It's not confirmed, we've got a date. And for events that we're launching in 2019, I'm working on them at the moment, literally, you know, day-to-day type thing. So, yeah, it's a, I think it's much longer than people actually, than they might realise. And we're lucky we've got 2 full-time members of staff in the operations team, 2 full-time staff in the marketing team. We've got 2 full-time staff that are answering emails, social media. So we've actually got quite a, you know, we've got from an organizer, we're actually relatively not big, I wouldn't certainly not big, but we're much more, we're bigger than a one-man band that's doing out of his spare bedroom evenings and weekends type thing. So yeah, we're set up pretty well from an infrastructure wise as well.
The Outlaw's been running, as we said, for 9 years, and you have pretty much used the same course, the same roads, the same villages. Does that make your job easier, or do you get the same resistance from people who are living on the course and whose lives are disrupted for 24 hours every year?
Yeah, does it make it easier? In some ways it does. Does it make it harder? In some ways it does. Quite simply, from our point of view, we can plan and we know where this road closure needs to go, that sign needs to go out. But on the flip side of that, you're dead right. We've got residents that if they're annoyed in 1 year, then they're annoyed. They're even more annoyed the year you come back, and even more annoyed the third year, the fourth year. And then when you get to year 9, they really hate you, or they've learned to live with it. And we've had some good communications, and things have been, people have been appeased. So yeah, it's a little bit of both. I would say there are more events on the highways nowadays, literally. Cycling is massive. Around where the Outlaw is or other events that we've got coming up, there's a lot of cyclists about, and I think we've probably all spotted it just recently, but, you know, it seems to be, and it's certainly not from our point of view, but there seem to be a minority of the general public that think it's great to bash a cyclist. And it's something that we've got to be aware of, and that's not only happening on the roads, that's actually happening sort of with the general public as a whole. So it's, we're certainly getting much more, we're having to work harder to get our events into certain areas, because we're much more visible, you know, and there's certainly, but there's more cyclists, so we're, you know, we're out on the roads in bigger groups, slowing more people down, and there's a, as much as there's a feel-good factor, on the opposite to that, there are more people that just don't like cyclists and travellers. And so, yeah, this year has been quite a challenge, if I'm honest.
You do have close roads, particularly the Outlaw, but they're only for a restricted time, aren't they? It's not full day road closure. How difficult is it to negotiate full road closure for the whole event for a full day? You know, like, I mean, yeah. there are some races I know in the UK that get this, but they're very rare.
Yeah, and You know, the ones that I can think of from a triathlon point of view are either the likes of mixed relays that we organised a few weeks ago, BBC televised events. But then you're looking at Ironman, you know, being realistic and open. You know, they're the people that are able to actually get closed roads all day. And it's tough. The difference between us and the Ironman events, apart from that, is the backing that they get from the council. We get no formal support from any of the councils that we work with in a monetary kind of way. And that's predominantly the difference there. If I could organise Outlaw being fully road closed, would I? No. I think from our point of view, and within reason, I'm the person that they talk to, I'm pretty visible. And so when we get a complaint in, it normally comes through to me. And you know something, I think it's necessary? Well, we've been going 9 years, we're getting decent numbers, we're still developing the brand, developing the sport. I don't think it's always necessary. And people have got that choice as well. If people want to go and do a fully closed road event, they've got that choice. What I would say is our attitude as athletes needs to be better in some cases. I think this year, the attitude of the motorists has been more aggressive, but equally so. I think I've seen some of our riders riding, and I don't actually think sometimes we help ourselves. And so I think we need to get that right. We've got certain expectations of what I expect an outlaw to be and to do. And I think we're possibly just missing them. Some people, and it's certainly I'm talking again minority, some people possibly missing the mark about what they're doing, what they should be doing, what should be aiming for when they're doing an outlaw event. You're not going to qualify for Kona in the nicest possible way. You could go 9 hours, but you're still not going to qualify for Kona. So I think we our offer is slightly different to what Ironman offer. And on that basis, I'd expect people to have a more of an enjoyable day when they're out on the roads and not possibly worry about losing 5 seconds going around a corner, possibly being slowed up by a motorist.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah,
I think that's one of the issues we've got.
I guess you're talking about incidents like the horse on the course, which we saw at Windsor, where Pete, you know, there's obviously somebody was on the course. I don't know if that road was fully closed, was it? But definitely people are infringing what I call normal human etiquette by undertaking a potentially volatile creature on the inside at speed and putting several people's lives at risk. Not just scaring the horse.
They're putting not only their lives at risk. I mean, we've seen when it's done, and we've had emails about our events that mention the horse on the course. And so it's not only bringing themselves into disrepute, it's the sport as well. And, you know, I have no idea whether Windsor will even be able to happen again. And that's just, you know, it's just a general statement. I've got no specifics there. But I do know it's very hard to organise events in Windsor. So, yeah, I think, you know, that sort of thing is pretty awful.
So what you're really saying there is we've all got to be aware of each other. The motorists have got to be more aware and more accommodating for the cyclists. But equally, the people who are entering outlaw events or any other event really have still got to be aware that just because they're in an event, it doesn't give them right of way over the whole road, and that there will be other road users. And times that even on sections where it's closed, they may encounter obstacles because somebody who's got a grudge has decided to ignore some cones. And I guess that is a challenge that you faced as a race director, is you're thinking the road's closed, but somehow somebody or something has got onto the course.
There's so many different options that you're dealing with. Ultimately, they need to get it right once. So if you've got someone that's throwing tacks down or oil down or setting fires next to the course, which I know has happened elsewhere, you know, that all they need to do is actually get it to be able to do it once. That affects the whole of the event, the reputation of the event and that type of thing. So, yeah, and on the opposite, you know, we're not close roads, and we have to understand that, yeah, there will be motorists on the course. But one thing that we've actually done this year is since the last event, where I've actually getting some signs printed that say, motorists, thank you for your patience. Because most of our signage goes out and it's all about telling the athletes what to do. Whereas sometimes I think, and we do have a few signs in a couple of areas that say, please be patient. But we've just got some signs out that say, thank you for your patience. Because reality is we probably need to thank motorists sometimes, and we hopefully that they'll see those and that we have an understanding that we are slowing them down. That's what's changed in the last few years. We've never had the same issues that we've had previously, but as a business, we're now dealing with greater numbers. We're possibly using slightly different routes that we would have used a few years ago as well.
I think that this sort of angst from other people, not non-triathletes, is something that affects races all around the world. I remember Ironman Canada a few years ago where somebody on the course put out tax. I mean, most of the residents there were actually in favour of the race because it brought a lot of tourism to the area. But there's always some people who are upset that it's going to disturb their morning. Likewise, residents in Kona don't look forward to the Ironman going. It gets bigger every year and the athletes there think that they have right of way, you know, and that they're more important than the people who live there, you know, and have been living there for 20 years. Likewise, I think you mentioned somebody pouring oil on the course. I think that happened in Tenby last year on some of the nasty, you know, what are already tricky downhill. So I don't think any event is immune from that. You did touch on how things have changed, Ian, and you've been organising races now for 20 to 25 years. So how do you think the sport has changed from an event organisation perspective, through to the types of people you're getting, through to the things like social media and the power that that has and the digitization of everything and the immediacy of everything that happens these days. Can you just cover a few of those things that have changed? Let's talk about race organization now. So how have things become harder and how have they become easier as we've moved into the 21st century?
Okay. Things are easier in some ways. I can, for me to go and check a road nowadays within reason, I can go onto certain bits of software that we've got and go and have a look at a certain junction or something like that. So that makes life easier. I can go onto a website and find out if there's going to be roadworks and utility works and that type of thing. So technology does assist us. I think on the negative side of things, there's a number of forums that we can all go onto to read about events, and you can accidentally, not intentionally, frustrate somebody, and they can just, within reason, kill your event. You know, in actual fact, what's happened, we've certainly had this, whereas someone's had a bad experience, they've had a bad experience, not because of the race, because of something else, but they then score it 0 out of 5. And so next thing you know, you've got this awful review that looks pretty awful. But you can't affect, but actually that's had nothing to do with your event. Obviously, you know, people can go and put good reviews up. And on the whole, I think we tend to be liked on the social media side of things. Our marketing, you know, I've got 5 years ago, if somebody says we'd be employing 2 people to work full time on our social media, you wouldn't have believed it. You'd have literally gone, nah, you wouldn't do that. And that's what we have nowadays. We've got 2 people that are permanently looking at all of our media channels. And so that's what's massively different. The urgency has changed. Literally, people come across the finish line, they want to know their split, they want to know where they are in their category, they want their pictures, they want their friends to know that they've just finished, they want to see a live feed. You know, years ago, I remember doing, I'd be grateful if I got results within through the letterbox in a couple of weeks.
Well, I can remember. So my first events, you would find out about a race from the back pages of 220 magazine from the classifieds, or you get a flyer stuck on your car at events, or you pick something up in the local leisure centre. You then send off a form with a stamp addressed envelope asking for some race entries to be sent through to you. You then fill in the race entry and send a stamp addressed envelope off to the organiser. And a couple of weeks later, a big envelope would arrive through with a cardboard number and a map and some details of the route and maybe a list of the other entrants and some directions on how to get there and some more instructions on the start of the race and everything else. So then you had to go and try and find somewhere to stay and work out where this event was. And then you just turned up and you went and registered and you did it on the morning. You stood in line with everybody else and you had to show your registration card and then you got ticked off on a sheet and then you went and racked your bike and then the race started And then after you finished, you got your T-shirt and your medal and you drove home. And then a few weeks later, another big envelope would arrive through with your handwriting on it, which would be the Stamperjest envelope with the results of the race that you'd done 3 weeks ago that you'd forgotten about. But then you start going yeah. through it to do some analysis. I mean, that's probably 20 years ago, and things have changed massively now, haven't they?
And I remember you were grateful if they'd done your splits.
Oh, splits. I remember having to try and work out those, what my splits were, how many seconds I'd taken on this. And then if I wanted to work out where I finished in my age group or how far I was behind anybody, you had to make a list. You had to go through and tick all the people that were in your age group and work out their splits. And
yeah,
so different.
It's massively different. And ultimately, it's a different sport. I wouldn't have, I mean, years ago, 20 years ago, I don't think there were any commercial organisers. There might have been Banana Leisure. I think they were doing a bit. 220 Triathlon Magazine, they did a bit. But yeah, I mean, Kevin, nowadays,
Lorraine Ferris was doing some stuff, wasn't she then, I think?
Yeah, but I think she was working for 220 there, wasn't she?
Yeah, did. And what about who was organising some events back then? Well, John Lund had his human race thing. That's been going for a while.
But
there weren't many people that were there weren't many people that were able to do it and make a living from it, really, were there? And sustain that over a number of years.
I mean, I think this year we'll turn about 1.5 million. And years ago, when I was messing about with sheets of paper, doing timing off a hand stopwatch and that type of thing, you would have never believed that the business, this is now a business ultimately. But we've now got a business that employs 9 people. You know, we've got a boardroom that I'm sat in. We've got, you know, we've got a separate warehouse. We run a fleet of vehicles. You know, it's different. The sport itself, as much as it's still swim biking and running, it's a different sport. It's very on the edge all the time. We're setting new standards. You know, a triathlon organizer is able to flick to doing running events, cycling events, and swim events very easily because we're multifaceted. We've got all of the skills to be able to do that. And so, things are different. I think the athletes used to be quite, they could look after themselves. I remember first year we did Vitruvian. We had one feed station, whereas nowadays we'll put more feed stations out, give bottles away on the run. There's a feed station every mile within reason. So I think, you know, we have to work harder than we used to, but I think, you know, there's more people doing the event.
There's two more things I'd like to ask you, and before we go, clearly, as somebody who's worked at your events, I've always been impressed with the number and the quality of the volunteers you have, and I think you'd be the first to admit that business that you talked about wouldn't exist without the support of those volunteers, because those people they turn up at all of your races and they've been doing so for several years.
Yeah, and that's one of the nice things that we get, and one of the nice things, and I was having this conversation this morning actually, is our crew and our volunteers are absolutely amazing, and they do it because they want the athletes to have a good time. And you know, it's a balance. We have a number of paid people, but the clubs, and I think we've got something like 9 clubs helping at the Outlaw this year, and those clubs come along because it's, you know, it's social, but ultimately the end game is that they want to help the athletes have a good day, and that's what's amazing. That's what is really good about sport. Certainly very much it changed, and we say everything has to be immediate and that type of thing. The thing that hasn't changed is the community feel, certainly from our point of view, and it's something we work hard to get, is that community feel about how our events feel. And that I always try and make myself available. All of our team, everybody knows within reason, everyone, you know, we all know that Steve's going to be looking after the bike course because Steve looks after the bike course. And it's one of those things, we try and make ourselves available. And big thing, and probably the biggest thing that keeps us winning awards and that type of thing, are the volunteers that we get. We look after them. We like to do that, and we like to, you know, get along well and make sure that everyone gets something unique from the day. The crew, I can't thank our crew and our volunteers enough. And you need to experience it to actually get an understanding of why they do it. But yeah, that's our biggest thing and what's possibly slightly unique about the success of our events. The touch point is very important. And from my point of view, the touch point is whenever an athlete comes into contact with somebody, we always try and keep it as somebody that understands the sport. So a triathlete from another club or something like that. So, but yeah, thanks for bringing that one up because I was trying to find out how I could bring it into the conversation.
Final thing then. We've talked about this a few times. We've referred to your length of time in the sport of triathlon. Where do you see it going in the next? Where do you see it going in the next 5 or 10 years? You must be as well positioned as anybody within this country to sort of spot some of the trends for triathlon and triathlon events in the next few years. So, what just to put you on the spot there? I said I wasn't going to do that, but I am now. Where do you think triathlon's going to go in terms of the types of events? You know, do you see that it's peaked out, or do you think there's still room for improvement and growth?
Yeah. Is there room for improvement and growth? I think we're probably close to its peak at the moment. I think there's a lot of challenges. We've certainly got too many events. Hopefully the strong ones will continue, the ones that aren't giving a good service, and an athlete comes to and has a crap race because it wasn't organised well. They didn't like the T-shirt. They got ripped off. Because some people, literally, I see some races and I think they're ripping people off. So hopefully they're going to disappear and they'll leave the ones that are good quality, well put on, sort of like value for money. They're going to leave those about. So everyone that comes into the sport gets a good gets good experience and wants to do more. So that's the first thing. And I think that's starting to happen. So we're around about 200,000 race starts per year, 200,000, 220,000. I think that's probably where we are from a capacity point of view. Age group racing will continue. I think that's always going to be a good buoyant market. I think the Federation needs to sort out what their offer is. They can't work out whether they're an organiser or whether a Federation. They organise a lot of events. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong. And I have these conversations with them. From a media point of view, because ultimately it's the media that drives participation. So we've had the Brownlee effect, and that's without doubt made a massive difference to people getting into triathlon. Have we lost that? We haven't lost it yet. Are we close to losing it? Well, that's probably a different conversation. But from a media, so I think that the media are into the sport. BBC have got a contract to televise certain events. So I think we're now there. We're now more of a main sport. I think we need to get a decent offer together to bring people into the sport and make it simple. And then from there, I think the long distance market is now harder. So full outlaw, full Ironman distance, I think it's quite a tough market. Middle distance is really buoyant though. We sell outlaw half Nottingham in less than 24 hours. And that's getting close to 2000 entries. So the middle distance market's good. And I think that's going to sustain itself. But we need to keep people within the sport, and that's by offering good service, good events. We need to make the sport sticky, so making sure we've got a good club structure and that type of thing. Yeah, I think we're all right at the moment.
Well, that's been very interesting again. Thank you. A nice journey through 30 years of triathlon, because you have been around for long enough to have pretty much seen it from its inception in this country to the mature stage it's at now, with it being an established Olympic sport, having our own Olympic champions, having our own outlaw distance champions in Hawaii. And for those people who are listening and wondering what this little in-joke is, when I do some commentary at Ian's events, and a while ago we decided we weren't going to mention other brands, but what we were going to do was, if we did refer to them, we would call them outlaw distance events, and it just makes everybody chuckle. So, but we all have to exist in the same space, so everybody's pretty friendly.
And let's be honest, I mind a bloody good job.
And, I do, yeah.
It keeps, if I like to go to Ironman Lanzarote every year, I think that's a great event to go to. Just happened to be on the same event, same weekend as one of our own events now, so that makes it slightly tougher.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll see you at some of those events one day, Ian. back again, racing, when I'm racing, maybe to celebrate your 50th birthday, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Okay, well, listen, Ian, as you said, you've got a lot of work to do. When you listeners are listening to this, we'll have just a few days to go until the 2018 edition of The Outlaw Full. I'll be there with my co-commentators. Ian will be there on site, as will all of those fantastic volunteers that he talked about and mentioned. If you're coming down to either spectate or watch, hope to see you there. Please do say hello. But for those of you who are racing and think that you're entitled to certain things, please do be mindful of the hard work that goes on behind the scenes between the race directors and the volunteers and the race directors and the people that give them permission to run those events. It's not guaranteed, and sometimes nature or something else has a habit of intervening to alter the race that you've planned for. But that I can guarantee, and I'm sure Ian will confirm, that no race director wants to have to significantly change anything about the event that's being advertised and sort of give the customers slightly less than they were expecting. But sometimes it just has to be that way in order to make sure an event goes ahead at all. Would that be right, Ian?
Yeah, ultimately safety is paramount. And some people don't like that. But I think sometimes if the shoe was on the other foot, so to speak, and they were the ones that need the help, then they would fully understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. So hopefully you don't see that as a negative point to end on. It's been a fantastic run through of triathlon history from somebody who's been there for most of it. So thank you very much, Ian, for joining us today. It's been a great conversation, and maybe we can get you back on at another time to talk about some other aspects of triathlon.
Yeah, possibly. That'd be fun. But I'll see you soon, Simon.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. So listeners, thank you again for listening today. I do appreciate you joining us each and every week. I know that there are other podcasts that you could choose to listen to, so your loyalty is really fully appreciated. I hope that you can join us again next week when we'll have another smashing guest. But for now, thanks for being here. Bye for now. That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today, and I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. You could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon and 20 years of coaching, I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com, and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.